The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everyone. Come on. Good evening, everyone. Great. We have just a terrific program for you, and I want to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Kevin Vaughn, and I'm the Associate Director. Our guest, Bill Bryson, is a man of many hats, but only one head, and somehow that head and his hands have become wonderfully proficient and remarkably accomplished at writing two types of books, namely The Witty History of the English Language and The Wiseacre Travelogue. Perhaps you favor one type over the other. Maybe you're a fan of the travelogues. In Lost Continent, Bryson searched for the perfect small town in which, as he says, Bing Crosby would be the priest, Jimmy Stewart the mayor, Fred McMurray the high school principal, Henry Fonda a Quaker farmer, Walter Brennan would run the gas station, a boyish Mickey Rooney would deliver groceries, and somewhere at an open window, Deanna Durbin would sing. Sound familiar? Or perhaps you favor notes from a small island. You wouldn't be alone. During the World Book Day, an annual celebration of reading and the printed word in the United Kingdom, Bryson's affectionate portrait of Britain was chosen as the travel book which best sums up England's identity and the state of the nation in the 21st century. In addition to his bestsellers about Australia and a sunburned country and the Appalachian Trail, A Walk in the Woods, he has written more than a few marvelous explorations of the English language. His formal study of English and how it got that way, the mother tongue, is an anecdotal historical survey of what Bryson calls the most important and successful language in the world. The mother tongue was warmly received by critics who considered the book lively and engaging, as well as a motherload of delectable trivia. Bryson's follow-up book, Made in America, An Informal History of the English Language in the United States, tracks the North American usage from the Puritan utterances of the Mayflower's pilgrims to the postmodern definition of obscenity occasioned by the photographs of Robert Mapplethorpe. Bryson's hometown paper, the Des Moines Register, described the book as a wonderfully entertaining history of American English, of how it and its people and the country developed. Bryson's interests in hat collection have continued to develop. He now has the temerity to bring us a science book entitled A Short History of Nearly Everything. It's vintage Bryson, informative and witty, character-driven and charming. It's also a brilliant and inviting exposition of the most difficult ideas ever devised. But he'll tell you all about that in just a minute. Before I bring him out here, I just want to set a few house rules for this very packed auditorium this evening. One, if you would please turn off your pagers and cell phones. I ask that there are no pictures taken here in the auditorium. Upstairs, afterwards, we're going to, of course, many of you have already bought books, and I know that there's still some more up there, for people to have signed. And we know that there's going to be a very long line. We're asking that anyone with 5 or more books, I saw some people with 15, please stand to the rear of the line, because we know that there are people who are just going to have one or two, and we'd like to accommodate them. Collectors will have to wait till that is done. The last thing I'll say is that because of the length of the line, we're going to Mr. Bryson will personalize one of your books. He'll autograph any others beyond the one, just because the length of the line is going to be so unwieldy. But we ask you all to help us work with those rules. And now I'd like to please welcome our guest for the evening, Bill Bryson.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's great to be back in Philadelphia. And thank you, Kevin, for those kind words. This is fabulous. It's a wonderful space. It wasn't actually very long ago that I did a reading to a group of 5 people at a Barnes & Noble in Roanoke, Virginia. Honestly, of whom one was the manager of the store, so clearly she wasn't going to buy any books. Two others were actually friends of my parents who had retired to Roanoke from Des Moines and simply wanted to know how my mom and dad were. This is absolutely true. The fourth guy was a man who was also named Bill Bryson, which he thought was so fabulously comical that he had driven all the way to Roanoke from Stanton, Virginia, in order that we could stand together and look at his driver's license and confirm that we did indeed have, amusingly, have the same name. And finally, the fifth person was a woman I suppose you could describe as his future former wife. Because it was pretty obvious that she didn't want to be spending her evening with any Bill Brysons. So to find myself in a situation like this with so many happy, smiling faces is both startling and really very, very gratifying. So I am sincerely grateful to you for turning out tonight. But it's also deeply unnerving because every time I get up in front of an audience like this, I'm always afraid that you're going to expect me to say something significant and even profound. And I'm afraid I've never been very good at profundities. I always just sort of blurt out the wrong thing. I get asked profound questions all the time, but I just don't seem to have the knack for giving profound answers. The last time I can remember was I had to do an author questionnaire for a publication of W.H. Smith, which is a British bookstore chain. And one of the questions on this questionnaire was, what would you like people to be saying about you 100 years from now? It's quite a tough question. And I thought really hard about the answer. And the answer I gave was, and the amazing thing is, he's still sexually active. But having said that, I am going to have to try and be a little more profound than usual here tonight because, as Kevin told you, I have a slightly more serious and somber book to try to present to you. It's a book called A Short History of Nearly Everything. But before we do that, if you'll indulge me, there's something I'd really like to do. It's not often I get to get up in front of such a good-looking and influential-looking audience as this. And a few years ago, in my capacity as a self-appointed conscience of the universe, I announced a new program of rules for the planet. And I'm very disappointed to tell you that these have not yet been widely adopted anywhere. So I was hoping that you might allow me to reintroduce them here tonight in the hope that you will take them seriously and take them out into the wider world and help to make the world a better place. There are only 12 of these rules, but they are very important to me, and I really would be very grateful if you would take them all to heart. In order to make the world a better place, the following rules will take force with immediate effect across the planet. 1. It is no longer permitted to be stupid and slow. You must choose one or the other. 2. People who wear articles of clothing on which the manufacturer's name or logo is prominently displayed must also wear a badge saying, "Yes, I am an idiot." Thank you. Thank you. 3. When standing in line to purchase food or beverages, anyone who has to leave the line to ask his or her partner whether the partner wants a sugar cone or a plain cone, or chocolate powder on their cappuccino, or a cinnamon stick, or anything like that, will be escorted from the premises. Anyone who reaches the front of a line and says, "Now what do I want?" and purses his lips thoughtfully and drums his fingers on his chin while studying the ordering options as if for the first time, will be taken outside and shot. 4. Any electronic clock or other timing device on which the time is set by holding down a button and scrolling laboriously through the minutes and hours is illegal. Also, when you're trying to set the alarm on such a device for, say, 7 a.m., and the numbers get to about 6:56 and then suddenly speed up, and you discover to your dismay that you have gone past the desired hour and have to start all over again, that is extremely illegal. 5. Photocopiers will clearly indicate where you are supposed to put the piece of paper you want photocopied, and will provide an immediate refund and spoken apology each time they produce a horizontal photocopy when a vertical one is desired. Any user of a photocopier who instructs the machine to produce a tablecloth-sized photocopy or 100 copies of a single document or anything like that, and who then does not reset the machine to its normal settings, will be hunted down by the photocopier police and made to drink a cup of toner. 6. All cars will come equipped with gas caps on both sides. Thank you. And all gas station hoses will be at least 6 feet longer. 7. If you are a repairman, it is henceforth against the law to expect me to know where anything is. I cannot show you the location of fuse boxes, stop cocks, shut-off valves, outflow channels, compressors, outlet manifolds, or anything with the word sump in it. 8. Supermarkets henceforth are required to put everything where a middle-aged man who doesn't shop much can find it. 9. In office buildings and other premises in which entry is through double doors, and one of those doors is locked for no reason, the door must bear a large sign saying, "This door is locked for no reason." 10. Thank you. 10. With immediate effect, the following are illegal: tofu, low-fat cheese, pronouncing etc. as if it had a K in it, saying in any circumstances that you are seeking closure, thinking that if you put a little bit of food that I really don't want to eat on the end of a fork and waving it in my face, it will somehow become attractive to me, and all medical procedures ending in the word oscopy. 11. All reviews of Mr. Bryson's work will, with immediate effect, be submitted to Mr. Bryson for correction and helpful revision before publication. And finally, 12. All Americans will appreciate irony. All Britons will understand that 2 ice cubes in a drink is not nearly enough. Thank you for helping to make the world a better place. Your cooperation is appreciated. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. As I said, I'm here tonight. I'm on a book tour, and the idea of it is that I'm supposed to be trying to sell the world on this new book of mine, which is this. It's called A Short History of Nearly Everything. It's not an easy book to present to an audience, I'm finding, because it doesn't have a lot of passages that lift out neatly and make self-contained readings. And also, it's not even really a very easy book to describe to an audience, because it is kind of all over the place and slightly disordered and charmingly so, I hope. But it's a kind of a sprawling topic. And for 4 years, I've been editors in New York and London both have been phoning me up and saying, you know, what are you doing? And I would say, well, I'm not sure exactly. And they'd say, well, what's it about? And I would say, well, it's about everything, nearly. And that's kind of where the title came from. It's more of a reflection of what it felt like I was trying to do rather than perhaps what I've actually succeeded in doing. But the idea of it, I think, is that it's really looking at a lot of very, very basic, elemental facts, all of which are truly amazing when you stop and think about them, but which most of us never stop and think about. I mean, consider, for instance, your own existence, the fact that you are here alive in the 21st century. You may not feel like it, but every one of you is a kind of a little miracle. You know, in order to be here now, millions, trillions and trillions of drifting atoms had somehow to come together to create you. You represent an arrangement of atoms that has never existed before. The whole history of the universe, atoms have never gotten together before to create anything quite like you. And when you die, they will all go off to become other things, and nothing exactly like you will ever exist again. And that, if you ask me, is a pretty amazing fact, that we each get this existence, and that atoms get together all over the universe, but as far as we know, they don't do it anywhere else where it creates living, animate, delightful, interesting things like us. So that's sort of what the book is about. It's looking at how did that happen. It's just asking how did we get here? What happened? You know, what caused us to be here now? And when you start asking a question like that, you have to go back and back and back. I found, and you go back eventually to, really, you have to go all the way back to the beginning of it all with the creation of the universe and the Big Bang, some 13.7 billion years ago or so they seem to think now, and that's really so what the book is about. It's looking at how we went from there being nothing at all, no universe, nothing, to there being something, and then how some of that, a little bit of that something, turned into us. Now, one of the delights for me in doing the book was discovering that all that we know is dependent very, very heavily on the work of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of often delightful, sometimes eccentric, occasionally inspiring, but almost entirely unsung people who devoted whole lifetimes and done all kinds of heroic work in order to add just a small fragment of knowledge to the great body of what is known. Two of my favorites I'd like to read you a passage about were English guys, the father-son team of JBS and John Scott Haldane. Their speciality was human physiology and working out human tolerances for extremes. They were active in Oxford in the from I think around about the 1920s into the 1940s and a little beyond. A great deal of what we know about surviving at extremes is owed to the extraordinary father and son team of John Scott and J.B.S. Haldane. Even by the demanding standards of British intellectuals, the Haldanes were outstandingly eccentric. The senior Haldane was born in 1860 to an aristocratic Scottish family, but spent most of his career in comparative modesty as a professor of physiology at Oxford. He was famously absent-minded. Once, after his wife had sent him upstairs to change for a dinner party, he failed to return and was discovered asleep in bed in his pajamas. When roused, Haldane explained that he had found himself disrobing and had assumed it was bedtime. His idea of a vacation was to travel to Cornwall to study hookworm in minors. Haldane's son Jack, known to posterity as J.B.S., was a remarkable prodigy who took an interest in his father's work almost from infancy. At the age of 3, he was overheard demanding peevishly of his dad, "But is it oxyhemoglobin or carboxyhemoglobin?" Throughout his youth, the young Haldane helped his father with experiments. By the time he was a teenager, the two often tested gases and gas masks together, taking it in turns to see how long it took each of them to pass out. Whereas his father's principal interests concerned miners and poisoning, the younger Haldane became obsessed with saving submariners and divers from the unpleasant consequences of their work. With Admiralty funding, he acquired a decompression chamber that he called the pressure pot. This was a metal cylinder into which 3 people at a time could be sealed and subjected to tests of various types, all painful and nearly all dangerous. Volunteers might be required to sit in ice water while breathing aberrant atmosphere, or subjected to dangerously rapid changes of pressurization. In one experiment, Haldane simulated a dangerously hasty ascent to see what would happen. What happened was that the dental fillings in his teeth exploded. Almost every experiment, one chronicler has written, ended with someone having a seizure, bleeding, or vomiting. The chamber was virtually soundproof, so the only way for occupants to signal unhappiness or distress was to tap insistently on the chamber wall or to hold up notes to a small window. On another occasion, while poisoning himself with elevated levels of oxygen, Haldane had a fit so severe that he crushed several vertebrae. Collapsed lungs were a routine hazard. Perforated eardrums were quite common, too. But, as Haldane reassuringly noted in one of his popular essays, the drum generally heals up, and if a hole remains in it, although one is somewhat deaf, one can blow tobacco smoke out of the ear in question, which is a social accomplishment. What was extraordinary about this was not that Haldane was willing to subject himself to such risk and discomfort in the pursuit of science, but that he had no trouble talking colleagues and loved ones into climbing into the chamber, too. Sent on a simulated descent, his wife once had a fit that lasted 13 minutes. When at last she stopped bouncing across the floor, she was helped to her feet and sent home to cook dinner. Haldane happily employed whoever happened to be around, including on one memorable occasion a former Prime Minister of Spain, Juan Negrin, who just happened to be visiting. Dr. Negrin complained afterward of a minor tingling and a curious velvety sensation on the lips, but otherwise seems to have escaped unharmed. He may have considered himself very lucky indeed. A similar experiment with oxygen deprivation left Haldane without feeling in his buttocks and lower spine for 6 years. Well, one of the other things I discovered in doing the book was that we're also very dependent on our knowledge base. It's very dependent on people subjecting themselves to the most incredible privations and risk and dangers right throughout history. And again, it's something that I was very happy to celebrate in the book. I think never more notably than in the 18th century, when the world became positively gripped with an urge to understand all there was to know about the physical dimensions of the Earth, how big it was around, how much it weighed, where it rotated in space, how far it was from other celestial bodies. And people then realized that there was a way to find out exactly how far it was from the sun and the moon and the known planets. It was based on an idea that had been originated by Edmund Halley, the famous astronomer for whom Halley's Comet is named. And the idea was that if you measured a phenomenon known as a transit of Venus, which is simply the planet Venus passing across the face of the sun, if you measured this phenomenon from lots of different points on Earth and sort of compared notes very carefully, you could triangulate the distance from the Earth to the sun and therefore work out how far the sun was, and from that extrapolate out to the distance to all the other known planets. It would be a terribly exciting moment to know exactly where we were, get some sense of how big space really was. The trouble is that transits of Venus are very rare. They happen in pairs 8 years apart, but then are often absent for a century or more. There wasn't one in the 20th century, for instance. There wasn't one in Halley's lifetime after he had the idea that you could use it, so he was never able to do the experiment himself. But in the 18th century, in the sort of seventh decade of the 18th century, there finally came a moment when transits were about to happen, and the world got very excited. With the instinct for ordeal that characterized the age, scientists set off for more than 100 locations around the globe, to Siberia, China, South Africa, Indonesia, and the woods of Wisconsin, among many others. France dispatched 32 observers, Britain 18 more, and still others set out from Sweden, Russia, Italy, Germany, Ireland, and elsewhere. It was history's first cooperative international scientific venture, and almost everywhere it ran into problems. Many observers were waylaid by war, or sickness, or shipwreck. Others made their destinations, but opened their crates to find equipment broken or warped by tropical heat. Once again, the French seemed fated to provide the most memorably unlucky participants. Jean Schaap spent months traveling to Siberia by coach, boat, and sleigh, nursing his delicate instruments over every perilous bump, only to find the last vital stretch blocked by swollen rivers, the result of unusually heavy spring rains, which the locals were swift to blame on him after they saw him pointing strange instruments at the sky. Schaap managed to escape with his life, but with no useful measurements. Unluckier still was Guillaume Le Gentil, whose experiences are wonderfully summarized by Timothy Ferris in Coming of Age in the Milky Way. Le Gentil set off from France a full year ahead of time to observe the transit from India, but various setbacks en route left him still at sea on the day of the transit, just about the worst place to be, since steady measurements were impossible on a pitching ship. Undaunted, or perhaps just mildly daunted, Le Gentil continued on to India to await the next transit 8 years later, in 1769. With 8 years to prepare, he erected a first-rate viewing station, tested and retested his instruments, and had everything in a state of perfect readiness. On the morning of the second transit, June the 4th, 1769, he awoke to a fine day. But just as Venus began its pass, a cloud slid in front of the sun and remained there for almost exactly the duration of the transit. 3 hours, 14 minutes, and 7 seconds. Stoically, Le Gentil packed up his instruments and set off for the nearest port, but en route he contracted dysentery and was laid up for nearly a year. Still weakened, he finally made it onto a ship. It was nearly wrecked in a hurricane off the African coast. When at last he reached home, 11.5 years after setting off, and having achieved nothing, he discovered that his relatives had had him declared dead in his absence and had enthusiastically plundered his estate. Well, I won't test your patience with too much more, but I will read you just one more passage just to try and give you, I hope, some sense of what the book is trying to do. I started off by talking about, which it's an amazement that we're here because we are all a collection of obedient and strangely coordinated atoms. But that's only part of the story. So thank goodness for atoms. But the fact that you have atoms and that they assemble in such a willing and obliging manner is only part of what got you here. To be here now, alive in the 21st century and smart enough to know it, you had to also to be the beneficiary of an extraordinary string of biological good fortune. Survival on Earth is a surprisingly tricky business. Of the billions and billions of species of living things that have existed since the dawn of time, most, 99.99% in fact, are no longer around. Life on Earth, you see, is not only brief but dismayingly tenuous. It is a curious feature of our existence that we come from a planet that is very good at promoting life, but even better at extinguishing it. The average species on Earth lasts for only about 4 million years, or so it's thought. So if you wish to be around for billions of years, you must be as fickle as the atoms that made you. You must be prepared to change everything about yourself, shape, size, color, species affiliation, everything, and to do so repeatedly. That's much easier said than done, because the process of change is entirely random. To get from protoplasmal primordial atomic globule, as the Gilbert and Sullivan song put it, to sentient, upright, modern human has required you to mutate new traits over and over in a precisely timely manner for an exceedingly long while. So, at various periods over the last 3.8 billion years or so, you have abhorred oxygen and then doted on it, grown fins and limbs and jaunty sails, laid eggs, flicked the air with a forked tongue, been sleek, been furry, lived underground, lived in trees, been as big as a deer and as small as a mouse, and a million things more. The tiniest deviations from any of these evolutionary shifts, and you might now be licking algae from cave walls, or lolling walrus-like on some stony shore, or disgorging air through a blowhole in the top of your head before diving 60 feet for a mouthful of delicious sandworms. Not only have you been lucky enough to be attached since time immemorial to a favored evolutionary line, but you've also been extremely, make that miraculously, fortunate in your personal ancestry. Consider the fact that for 3.8 billion years, a period of time older than the Earth's mountains and rivers and oceans, every one of your forebears on both sides has been attractive enough to find a mate, healthy enough to reproduce, and sufficiently blessed by fate and circumstances to live long enough to do so. Not one of your pertinent ancestors was squashed, devoured, drowned, starved, stranded, stuck fast, untimely wounded, or otherwise deflected from its life's quest of delivering a tiny charge of genetic material to the right partner at the right moment in order to perpetuate the only possible sequence of hereditary combinations that could result, eventually, astoundingly, and all too briefly, in you. Thank you for that. Now, you know, it's asking an awful lot to ask people to spend $27.50 on a book on the basis of such a superficial stroll through its contents. So I'm very happy to tell you that the publishers have, in fact, authorized me to make a special offer, which is buy the book at the full asking price of $27.50 tonight. Take it home. Read it carefully. And if after 7 days you are not fully satisfied, you may keep the book. Now, just so we don't seem to be too earnest, I wonder if I could, I'd like to finish by reading you something that has nothing at all to do with the history of the universe or anything like that, but does lighten things up a little, I think. And then I have to tell you a story. But this is from a passage from a book called Neither Here Nor There, which is about traveling around Europe, a book I wrote a long time ago. But in fact, this passage has nothing to do with traveling around Europe either. It's just about why dogs don't like me. I don't know why it is, but something about me incites dogs to a frenzy. I would be a rich man if I had a nickel for every time a dog tried to get at the marrow in my ankle bone, while the owner just stood there and said, "Well, I don't understand it. He's never done anything like this before." You must have said something to him. That always knocks me out. What would I say to the dog? "Hello, boy, like to open a vein in my leg." The only time a dog will not attack me with a view to putting me in a wheelchair is when I'm a guest at someone's house, sitting on a deep sofa with a drink filled to the brim. In this case, the dog, and it's always a large dog with a saliva problem, will decide he doesn't want to kill me but to have sex with me. "Come on, Bill, get your pants off, I'm hot," he seems to be saying. The owner always says, "Is he bothering you?" I can put him out if he's bothering you. "Hey," I want to reply, "don't put him out, put him down." It wouldn't bother me in the least if all the dogs in the world were placed in a very large sack and taken to some distant island, Greenland springs attractively to mind, where they could romp around and sniff each other's anuses to their heart's content and never ever bother or terrorize me again. The only kind of dog I would excuse from this roundup is poodles. Poodles I would shoot. To my mind, the only possible pet is a cow. Cows love you. They are harmless. They look nice. They don't need a box to defecate in. They keep the grass down. And they are so trusting and stupid that you cannot help but lose your heart to them. Where I live in Yorkshire, there's a herd of cows down the lane. You can stand by the field wall at any hour of the day or night. And after a minute, the cows will all waddle over and stand with you. Much too stupid to know what to do next, but happy just to be with you. They will stand there all day, as far as I can tell, possibly till the end of time. They will listen to your problems and never ask a thing in return. They will be your friends forever. And when you get tired of them, you can kill them and eat them. Perfect. Thank you very much. Thank you. Now, the story I have to tell you is, my son, who's 24, read this book and pronounced it good. He thought it was a pretty good book. And so I said to him, "Well, then, you know, I'm just about to go out on the road on a book tour, so, like, what shall I read to audiences and what should I tell them?" And he said, "Tell them the bear story, Dad." Which was odd because there is no bear story in the book. What he meant was tell them the bear story that I told people when I was out doing a book called A Walk in the Woods about hiking the Appalachian Trail. So in his honor, I will tell you the bear story. Thank you. Which is simply that if you, you As you'll know, if you read A Walk in the Woods, when I was hiking the Appalachian Trail, I grew somewhat preoccupied with the dangers of bear attacks while hiking in America's wilderness. And I was gratified to discover, after the book came out, that thousands and thousands of people all over North America shared these concerns, because I got letters literally by the sackful from people giving me advice on how to avoid bear attacks while hiking. And here the basic advice seems to be to always go hiking with someone who can't run as fast as you can. But there was one letter I got from a lady in New Hampshire, where I now live, that particularly delighted me. She told me that when you go hiking out west in grizzly bear country, and grizzly bears are, of course, very dangerous animals, there are two things they tell you you should do. They tell you that, first of all, you should wear little bells on your clothing, because it actually alerts the bears you're coming and you don't overtake them by surprise. And the second thing they tell you you should do is that you should watch out wherever you go for grizzly bear scat or dung. And the way you can recognize grizzly bear scat is that it has little bells in it. And on that note, I would be delighted to answer questions from people about anything. I'm informed that you have to we have to get one of the people with microphones to get you first. So you have to so put up your hand, but don't start speaking until you've got a microphone in your mitt. Anyone? There's one here at the front. Oh, there's one here at the back, and then another one here. Hi.
Where are you living now?
Where am I living now? For the last 8 years, we've been in Hanover, New Hampshire. And we've just coincidentally, has nothing to do with anything. We're about to move. And we're going back to England. But we'll be back. I mean, not leaving the planet or anything. It's just we always intended to come for like 4 or 5 years. And we've been there for 8 years. And part of the reason we've been there for 8 years is we've been very, very happy. And I've developed this terrible affliction known as the Boston Red Sox. I'm helplessly attached to watching the Red Sox lose every summer. But we've been very, very happy. But we've always intended to go back at some point. And it's kind of with my kids. I've got 4 children, and they've reached just one of those moments when we can go back. I have a daughter who's just about to graduate from high school. So, and that leaves at home just a 12-year-old son. So it's an ideal moment to make a huge change. So it's nothing to do with any particular dissatisfaction with America just at the moment. Not exactly anyway. And it's just the time's coming. We don't know whether we're going there for, you know, we might come back after a few years, or we might stay longer. I don't know, but we'll certainly be back. I mean, a lot. We're very deeply attached to both countries. It's the most wonderful, marvelous position to be in, to have an affection for 2 different places and have passports that allow you to get into both. So we feel very lucky. Down here.
Hi. I find your books, like when I read them, I just laugh out loud. And yet I've heard that when you write, you don't laugh. And so that leaves me with 2 questions. First, is it that you don't find your own writing funny and they're just your observations and those of us who buy your books find them funny? Or you do find them funny, and if so, how do you know what's funny if you're not laughing at it?
Well, that's a really good point. It almost always, I don't laugh when I'm writing. I can only remember 1 or 2 occasions when I actually really laughed, when something just sort of came spontaneously. And I remember as my favorite thing I've ever written was I was doing riddles, and I was doing riddles about Adolf Hitler's last words to Eva Braun, And it just came to me, and it was what were Adolf Hitler's last words to Eva Braun? And they were, all right, I'll see to it that they name a range of small electrical appliances after you. And I couldn't stop laughing for about a half an hour. But that's the only time I can remember ever just, you know, something. Usually what happens is you get an idea. I mean, you know that a situation is somehow ridiculous or comical, or, you know, that it has potential, and you sort of play around with it, but for so long that it ceases being funny, and then you really do have a worry, is this funny? And it's always an amazing experience when you go out on the road with a new book and start reading, because of course the passages you prepare for an audience are the most dynamite stuff you think you've got, and it always turns out that there's at least a couple of those that just fail, which is, you know, very disconcerting, because, you know, you're supposed to think that you're have confidence in your stuff. But you find out that partly it's because the whole dynamics of what works on the page, someone reading in silence, is completely different from what works in an audience. Because really good puns never work with an audience, whereas they can work on a page. There's only one good pun I know, and this is true. And my father was a great punster, so I've not been very good at them myself, but I've always been appreciative of a good pun. And when we were in California, we were driving along the San Andreas Fault, and he rolled the window down and threw a quarter out because he said he'd always wanted to be generous to a fault. Have you still got the, where's the microphone? You need to get it. Oh, there's one man down here. Oh, and somebody back here with it.
The past Sunday, the New York Times had a book review of your latest book. What did you think about that? About the review?
The review, I've only sort of, I got, somebody faxed it to me and it was all sort of smeary and just, it wasn't actually possible to read it through, but, it was wonderful. It had lines in it that publishers dream of, you know. I mean, it said something to the effect that the book was destined to become a classic of modern science writing or something, which is just, yes, thank you. But it was very strange because he didn't, because if you just read the first few paragraphs, it looked like the guy didn't like the book at all. And so it's very strange. But then the whole middle part was just all sort of smeary, and I couldn't read it. So, but I know the publishers were very happy. And, it was good.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I, too, am a stranger here myself. And I would be intrigued to hear about your likes and dislikes about the two different countries. You know, when you're living in the United States, what is it you miss about England? And when you're living in England, what is it you miss about the United States?
Okay, I'd be very happy to say that. When I'm in the United States, the thing I really miss about England is the sense of humor. And it's not that we don't have, you know, a capacity for telling great jokes here, but there's something about humor in Britain that makes it different from anywhere else on earth. And the British are actually, I mean, they're very funny when they mean to be, but they're even funnier when they don't know they're being funny. And in a way, I just find it so wonderful and endearing. And there's a story I can tell you that I think perfectly illustrates it. I have a friend named John, who's from Liverpool originally. I know him from London when we worked together on newspapers. But he went back to Liverpool one weekend to visit his family. And while he was there, his watch strap broke. So on a Saturday afternoon, he went into the city center to a jeweler's to get a replacement watch strap. And it happened that just ahead of him was this guy, another customer he had to wait for. And the customer was asking for a crucifix. Now, the young lady that was serving the customer was this sort of, ditzy. I mean, she was just a kind of Dolly Bird type. And obviously, she was didn't work in a jewelry shop full time and didn't really know. But she was agreeable, but not real bright, this is what I'm trying to say. And anyway, she went off, when this man asked her for a crucifix, she went off and rooted around to the back room and came out a moment later and said to him, "Do you want it plain or do you want it with a little man on it?" And I don't know why, but that could only happen in Britain, you know? What I miss in Britain about America is, I really do think what I miss is the friendliness of the people, the friendliness here. I mean, you really are made to be so welcome here. And the ease of life in America, I mean, is very, very attractive. We were just really, I mean, quite sincerely overwhelmed by how nice people were. When we first moved to Hanover, we didn't know a soul for hundreds of miles. And, you know, people, just a steady stream of strangers came up the front walks with, you know, cakes and pies and bottles of wine and things. Because they knew that some people had heard that all our worldly goods were on a container ship somewhere between Liverpool and Boston, but going evidently by way of Port Said and the Galapagos Islands. And these people brought us, you know, microwave ovens and lamps and just, you know, things that they had lying around. And most of these people I've never seen again. I mean, they just dropped them off and went away. It was really very heartwarming. So it was that, the kind of kindness of Americans counts for a lot. And baseball. Sorry, I'm getting confused because I forget you have to have a thing. Have we got somebody here? Hi.
Is it true that you had to strip totally naked to cross the pond in Maine with your pack above your head?
Well, it's true that we had to strip, but we didn't strip totally naked. That was, I mean, Katz and I were very good friends, but we only took these things so far. As I think it's, I mean, it's like, I hope I made it clear in the book that we were actually in our boxer shorts. I think we kept our boots on, but I can't actually remember that, but there was a certain measure of decorum in the exercise. But if you've ever hiked in Maine, I mean, they really do. The people who did the Appalachian Trail in Maine were just the cruelest human beings that have ever lived. Because most of the Appalachian Trail, it's either a logical path that sort of takes the line of least resistance, or there's a good reason for it. I mean, you can see that they didn't have a proper right-of-way, so they had to take the path straight up a mountain rather than sort of zigzagging it in a kindly way. But there's a kind of logic to it. In Maine, it's just like they just thought, this will really fuck them over. And it really is just like that. It's just, you just despair. But we were respectably attired. I think we have one back here. Sorry, I'm sorry. The lighting isn't very good once you go back a few rows. Is there somebody there? Yeah.
Hi. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
I'm a huge fan.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
probably because my husband and I, like you and your wife, have the enviable position of having lived in England and here. We've just recently moved back here and experiencing that after 12 years over there.
Wow.
And that's where I discovered you, when you wrote for the Mail on Sunday.
Right, right.
And that's how I got to know you. And I read most of your books, and I really, truly loved The Notes from a Smile, and that was, I loved that one. And the one you wrote when you came back here, after living in England and exploring this country with new eyes, I can't remember the title, though. Notes from a Big Country?
It's called I'm a Stranger Here Myself.
I think it was called Notes from a Big Country.
It had a different title, yeah.
I could really relate to that because of the we had a similar situation.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Yeah. Just by the way, that reminds me that they do, publishers increasingly do this, where they give books, where they insist that books have different titles. The British publishers and the American publishers can't agree on a title. And for one reason or another, and they just won't. When I did a book in Britain of essays about moving back to America, the British publishers called it Notes from a Big Country, because that sort of capitalized on an earlier popular book called Notes from a Small Island. But the American publishers didn't like that because they thought people would say, well, which big country? Or, you know, they wouldn't instantly associate it with America. So they made me come up with an alternative title, and I decided I'm a Stranger Here Myself, which actually I thought was a better title. I just hadn't thought of it originally. And so those two books exist with different titles, and I've had this happen also with the book I did on Australia. And the terrible thing that happens, you discover, is that people buy the book in one country and they go on vacation to the other. And they really do this. Some of you probably have had it happen to yourselves, but they say, oh, look, Bill Bryson's done another book on Australia. That's really just 6 weeks after the first one. That's it. And they actually buy the second one and then think that accuse me of conducting some terrible, cruel scam. I'm the one who gets all the filthy mail. So just watch out for that. I mean, it happens with books all the time. Sometimes in very peculiar ways that I mean, who knows what the reason is. I noticed that the book that is called Captain Corelli's Mandolin in Britain is just Corelli's Mandolin here. I don't know why they thought you couldn't handle Captain in the title. I don't know. But there's just these sort of little confusions. And sometimes, so be careful when you buy books. Now, somebody, man here?
Hello? Oh, sorry. What do you think of the work of Pete McCarthy and Tim Moore, who have seemed to have taken up your mantle in British travel writing?
Well, Pete McCarthy and Tim Moore are two British travel writers. They're very, very good, I mean, as far as I know, but I haven't actually read their books. I'm not announcing a position on them or anything. I just haven't. There's a lot of books in the world, and I've been reading about science for the last few years, and I haven't got around to them. I know Pete McCarthy personally, and I know he's a really nice guy, and he was a television presenter in Britain for a long time. And I have every reason to suppose that the sort of charm and humor that he brought to his television programs, he reproduces in the books. But I haven't quite got around to reading them yet. And Tim Moore, I've also heard really good things. But I will read them. I just... yes, somebody just here, I think?
Bill, I sometimes like to think there's a bit of a Stephen Katz in all of us. And I wondered, how is he doing, and when are we going to hear more about him?
Well, I'm pleased, because this was actually slower than usual. Usually somebody in the first two or three questions asks how Katz is. And so you've been politely holding back, I know. And I always tell him this, and he gets really, really genuinely excited, you know, when he says that somebody in Philadelphia cares about his well-being. And I hope you don't mind, but I usually tell him it was a really attractive lady. And that cheers him up a lot, too. But Katz is great. He's the most extraordinary person. And he went back at the end of our summer. He went back to Des Moines. He got a job working at a satellite printing plant of the Wall Street Journal, where they produce the Midwest edition of Wall Street Journal. So he's got a good, steady job and a decent wage. He met a really nice lady friend with whom he's been enthusiastically bonding for the last 4 or 5 years now. And he's not drinking. Most of the time, he's not drinking, which is a really good thing. He did stumble from time at Christmas time or just before. He did actually start drinking again and woke up in Oregon. When I say he's an extraordinary human being, he really is. He's the most addictive personality I've ever met. I mean, to not drink for him, it's a huge achievement because, I mean, he really, really just, you know, give him one beer and he just sort of runs off into the night and you don't see him for weeks. For a while, he was actually one of only two opium addicts in Iowa, which is a pretty desperate situation to find yourself in because the other was his supplier. So he's doing well. I mean, he's doing really, really well. I just anticipate another question. The book, and I couldn't quite understand why he was being so good-natured about it. And then I realized when we had a long conversation that he actually thinks the book is entirely fictitious. honestly, this was just, we had this very surreal conversation, and I was saying to him, I don't understand. I said, do you deny, for instance, throwing all that stuff over the cliff edge on the very first day? And he'll say, well, no. And he said, well, do you deny that I put your tent up for you the first night because you were too big a baby to do it yourself? And he said, well, no. And we kind of go through the whole book. And I said to him, well, where's the fiction? And he said, oh, it's just the way you tell it. So someone down here? This was a pair here.
Hi. That brings up about fiction, nonfiction. This most recent book, The Father and Son Team, for example, did you completely make them up? Did you get them from a newspaper story? where do you get your sources? And you said you've been reading a lot of science. So where do you get your inspiration, different magazines, the internet? Where do you get your sources that gives you the creative ability to embellish the stories.
Yeah, no, you were right at the beginning. I just made it all up. I read and read and read. My position with the book was that I'd always been confused and bored by science in school. And I had this suspicion that science had to be interesting, more interesting than, you know, Mr. Spain, my high school biology teacher, ever made it. And because I thought, you know, chemistry can't be boring because we are all chemicals and we're all subject to physical forces, and so physics ought to be interesting because, I mean, it's telling us about ourselves, and we're always interested in ourselves. So I just thought at some level it must be interesting, and I really felt like I'd like to understand it and see if there is. So my first challenge was I read and read and read and just tried to get myself slightly up to speed and to see if I could understand this stuff. And then it became a problem of trying to present it in a book in a way that was entertaining and accessible to the reader. And what I did was I found an awful lot of very patient, helpful scientists who would walk me through all this stuff and help me and correct me. And what I found was that it is maddening. It was a maddening process because, you know, as a sort of simple-minded person and as a kind of journalist, I wanted to keep everything simple. I wanted every explanation to be really simple and easily understood. And, of course, science is not like that. Science is complicated. It always is. And the kind of the analogy I could use is that if you think about something like if I were writing about baseball, my instinct would be to say, on the basis of what I was reading, my instinct would be to say, you know, there are two ways to be put out in baseball. You can strike out or you can hit a ball that's caught by a fielder. And I would want to write, I'd write that in the first draft and take it to my scientist friend, and he'd look at it and he'd say, oh, I'm sorry, no. There's actually a lot of other ways you can be put out in baseball. You can actually reach base safely and be put out trying to steal second. Or you can hit, reach base safely, and be forced out at second by a following batter. Or perhaps you're familiar with Rabinowitz's work on drop third strikes at Berkeley. And suddenly it's all getting way too complicated, you know, and I just thought, oh, God. And so often what I ended up doing was writing, I would write, nobody knows how many ways there are to be put out in baseball. So it's a certain amount of kind of fudging around the edges at times. But that was what I did. I depended very heavily on a lot of really kindly, patient people who steered me through it and took me out into the field sometimes and then checked the text afterwards. There's still bound to be some whoppy mistakes in there, but I think most people will recognize that at least my heart was in the right place. Here.
Thank you. I've read all your books, and I love every single one. And I was wondering if you had ever considered writing a piece of fiction, writing a novel or anything like that.
The thing that's really appealing about the idea of writing a novel is that, you know, you could spend a year in carpet slippers. You would never have to leave home. You could that's great. You know, I wouldn't have to go out and subject myself to discomfort and all that. I think that would be wonderful. But my problem is I just don't have a story. I haven't got a plot. And the great thing about travel books is you don't have to have a plot. I mean, all you have to do is have a trip. And then it seems, I mean, any book you write based on, I started here and I finished there, seems eminently logical. I mean, it's the greatest scam that's ever been invented. It really is because you get to go to all these wonderful places and pretend you're working and you just have to write it. You know, a book, and you get paid for it, and it's great. But I'm happy enough with that without having to try and do fiction as well. Perhaps just one more question before I should do somebody this side. Oh, you choose. How about this guy in the blue shirt halfway back?
Hi, Bill. It's obvious from your early work that you love the English language very much, In your recent book, you talk a lot about Einstein and Planck, about how they uncovered the mysteries of the universe. And what I was wondering was whether, if you ever think, with all the rampant irregularities and anomalies that the English language has, whether it's ever going to have a unifying code or theory or an E equals MC squared of its own.
No. No, never have, no. Perhaps just one more question. That's why a lady at the back is waving most insistently.
I saw recently kind of a shorter travelogue that you had done about some trips you'd taken in Africa, and I wondered if you were planning on doing any more extended works on that.
Oh, well, thank you. That's a really good one to finish on because it's a nice, worthwhile enterprise. I was approached some time ago by a guy from Care International, which is a charity that does really valiant work throughout the Third World, and asked me if I would be interested in going to one of their countries and visiting some of their projects. And initially, I was just going to go and write a magazine article, perhaps, something like that. And they decided that Kenya would be a good place for me to go for a number of reasons, partly because it's a fascinating country. It has huge problems, like most countries in Africa. I mean, there's a lot of poverty. There's HIV infection rates of 30 or 40% in some communities, and you know, just a lot of very profound problems. And Care is very deeply enmeshed in all this. They also run a huge Somalian refugee site out there. So they're doing a lot of stuff there. And but also, Kenya is not completely hopeless. You don't really get depressed going there in the long term because you realize that with just the right application of help and a good steady government for perhaps 10 or 15 or 20 years, you could really turn that country around. So, because it has such resources, wonderful people, beautiful, beautiful countryside, great wildlife, wonderful beaches. I mean, it has all kinds of potential for both agriculture and tourism and much else. So, I agreed to go there. And in the meanwhile, the publishers in both New York and London decided miraculously, astoundingly, that they would produce whatever I wrote as a slender hardback book, and that they would give all their profits to Care. I'd already agreed then to give my royalties to Care, so that everything was going to Care. And the book has been, I'm delighted to tell you, has been, in its quiet little way, it's been quite a success, because I think it's now raised something in the hundreds of thousands of dollars for Care. So it costs $12. It's nothing. No one can pretend that it's worth $12 as a reading experience. It's just about an 8-day trip I made to Kenya and then wrote about in 2 weeks. So it was all produced in a great rush. But what I keep telling people is that you're not really buying a book for $12. You're giving a donation of $12 to CARE, and you get a little book as a keepsake in return. So it's a really worthwhile enterprise. And I can tell you from having been there that your donations do make a material difference to a lot of people. Children will live because of people buying this book, and that's a pretty good thing, and I think perhaps a happy place to end. So let me say thank you all very, very much for coming and for having me here. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.